Okay, let's move on then to 6-7 to 8-26. Some of the main themes of this section, which I would describe as Jesus' ministry expands to Gentile lands. So he's been mostly working among the Jewish people to this point, and now he will also work among non-Jewish people outside of the land of Palestine, land of Israel. And another very prominent image of this section is the image of bread. The image of bread is used again and again and again. And so this seems to be not accidental, but Mark is using these stories that bread in them to make a particular point. You have in 6:35 to 44, you have the feeding of the 5,000 with bread and fish. In 7, you have a dispute where some persons see that the disciples eat without washing their hands. In 7:24 to 30, you get this marvelous little story of Jesus' encounter with a Gentile woman who asks that Jesus heal her daughter. And initially, Jesus kind of responds quite harshly by saying that we should not take the bread that belongs to the children and throw it to the dogs. We'll come back to that story a little bit later. Chapter 8, you get the feeding of the 4,000, again with bread and fish. And then finally, in 8:14 to 21, you have Jesus and the disciples in a dispute over, we'll see what the dispute is about, but the bread is used again there as a point of departure, a point of dispute. Okay, so the very first one, 6:35 to 44. Jesus feeds the 5,000. I'm sure you all know this story. I don't think we'll take time to read it, but he takes the loaves of bread and a few fish and feeds 5,000 people with it. Just a couple things to note on this text. Generally, as the way Mark writes the story, it appears that he intends us to understand that this first feeding story appears in Jewish territory, that side of the Sea of Galilee. Whereas when you get to chapter 8 and you have the feeding of the 4,000, you have this probably, where we are to understand that this is happening in Gentile territory on the other side of the lake. So Jesus is feeding Jews and Gentiles, and the significance of that we'll come back to in a moment. The other thing to note about this text is it begins in 6:34. It says Jesus has compassion on the crowd because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And that image is also extremely important here. Jesus is portrayed as a shepherd, which is a very important Old Testament image. I'll just note a couple of places. First of all, in connection with Moses, Moses is portrayed as being a shepherd early on, but then of course God calls him to lead the people of Israel out of Egypt. And when he's about to die, God appoints a successor to Moses, and that is Joshua. And back this is Numbers, book of Numbers, and it says the same thing, that Israel was like sheep without a shepherd, and Joshua then becomes the leader of Israel. And it's interesting, isn't it, that the name Jesus is the name Joshua. Jesus is the Greek form of the name Joshua. So there's a sense in which we can see Jesus here as taking up the mantle, even, I suppose, of Moses, but also going beyond Moses. The other place where this imagery comes up significantly in the Old Testament is in connection with the kings of Israel. The shepherd is used as an image for the king. Think of David, even King David himself, who was a shepherd boy before God called him to become the king of Israel. And in places like the book of Ezekiel, it speaks of God promising to send a king to Israel who will be like a shepherd over the flock and gather them and feed them and so forth. So it's really a messianic image, therefore. So Jesus is presented here as that messianic shepherd who feeds the flock. And if you read this story carefully, you'll notice certain things pop out at you, like he has them lie down on the green grass. And he's, of course, feeding them alongside the Sea of Galilee, which he has recently calmed. And what does that bring to mind? So, yeah, Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul, right? So, it seems this is probably not accidental that Jesus is being described in this way. Chapter 7 is long and complex. Quite a number of things going on here. But just to highlight a couple of things. It begins with a dispute over purity. You know, the Pharisees developed the Old Testament purity laws in different ways and extended them in certain ways, expanded them. So that the Pharisees, for example, had, or at least some of them appear to have had traditions of washing their hands and such before they eat, which is actually not mandated in Scripture, but this was a, you might say, an extrapolation of the Old Testament purity laws. And so the disciples are rebuked for not doing this, and this gets into then a long discussion where Jesus sort of rebukes the Pharisees for sticking to their human traditions while they ignore the explicit Word of God. Okay, and he gives examples of how they do this. And towards the end of this passage, in verses 20 and following, Jesus will make the point that it's not what goes into us that defiles us, it's what comes out. What comes out of the heart, right? Evil thoughts, fornication, theft, murder, adultery, covetousness, etc. So these are matters of the heart. Purity, so he's really redefining purity, isn't he? It's not a matter of bodily washings or this kind of a thing. It's really a moral matter that begins with the heart and then moves out, of course, to how we then also live. So he's redefining purity, but even perhaps more striking, in verse 18, I guess it is, whatever goes into a man from outside does not defile because it enters not the heart but the stomach and then passes on. And then it says, and at least in my text, it's in parentheses, but it says, thus he, Jesus, declared all foods clean. Well, that's pretty remarkable, isn't it? Because what it's actually saying is Jesus himself is understood here to be, in a sense, rewriting or revising the law of Moses. Because, you know, the law of Moses declares certain foods unclean for Jewish people. So, you know, that's a remarkable thing. Who can do that? Who can revise God's own law? Well, only God can, right? So Jesus is represented here as doing that. We've already seen, of course, some of this early on where Jesus is, you might say, pushing the boundaries of the law, and this is therefore getting him in trouble with the authorities, but here he's actually revising it. And the other thing that this does, of course, is if he declares all foods clean, this is in effect breaking down the boundary wall between Jew and Gentile, right? And this, of course, is another theme that comes in the New Testament. Think of Galatians 3:28, in Christ there is no Jew or Gentile, male or female, slave or free, male or female. Ephesians chapter 2 talks about Christ breaking down the walls of division between Jew and Gentile. We then come in 7:24-30 to this most interesting story about Jesus and this Gentile woman. And I think I will actually read this one. So Jesus arises and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And he entered a house and would not have anyone know it, yet he could not be hid. But immediately a woman, whose little daughter was possessed by an unclean spirit, heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. Now the woman was a Greek, a Syrophoenician by birth. And she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, let the children first be fed, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. But she answered, yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. And he said to her, for this saying you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter. And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone. This is one of the, I think, one of the most remarkable stories in the Gospels, and one of, in some ways, one of my favorites, actually. So Jesus has gone north to the region of Tyre and Sidon. So this would get him into what we would probably today call Lebanon, north of Israel, into Gentile territory. And he enters a house and he wants to hide. Okay, this is again this motif of secrecy that comes up again and again and again in Mark. But he can't hide himself. He is discovered. And this Gentile woman comes to him who has a daughter who's possessed by a demon and begs him to heal her. And Jesus makes this remarkable statement, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." Okay. Who are the children? Who are the dogs? The children are the Jews, right? The children of God, the children of Israel. And the dogs? The Gentiles, yeah. It's almost a shocking statement, isn't it? Perhaps challenges some of our images of Jesus, even, who we like to think of perhaps as always welcoming and ready to help. And this term, to call this woman a dog, is, you know, we have other evidence in Jewish literature of pejorative terms used for Gentiles, like dogs or even, you know, pigs, things like this kind of, it's indicating, of course, either their impurity or their, in some ways, a secondary status. And there have been attempts to soften the harshness of this saying, to say something like, well, what Jesus was really saying was they're puppies, or this kind of a thing. It's an affectionate thing. But I think that kind of, to do that, I think actually misses the point. I'm not sure that we can really, in the end, remove some of the harshness of this statement. And if you ask, well, how could Jesus say such a thing? I guess my explanation of this would be that we need to remember that Jesus was a human being. And he, therefore, on the first instance, he shared to some extent the views of his own people of the time. But also, I think what's at work here perhaps is, like any other human being, Jesus had limits on his time and energy. I mean, he had to sleep. He no doubt got tired walking the roads of Palestine. He could only do so much. And when you look at the Gospels, you find that he really seems to focus mostly on his own people. And when he does encounter, there are other stories in the Gospels where he encounters, you know, Samaritans or other Gentiles, and he generally, in the end, is willing to help them, and he heals them. But perhaps we have here a little bit of an insight into the fact that he also had his limits. Maybe that's what's going on here. But in any case, the woman finally prevails, right? Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs get to eat the crumbs. And you have to love that comeback, huh? It's an expression of persistent faith. It reminds you of perhaps other episodes in the Bible of Jacob wrestling with the angel, maybe, and finally prevailing, right, and being blessed. And so here, the woman does not give up. She persists in wrestling with Jesus, and she finally receives the blessing and prevails in a certain sense. So even if we can't have the bread, at least could we have the crumbs, Jesus? So the story is interesting, and certainly in of itself, but I also want to point out here that, again, you have this image of bread being here used here, don't you? And when you look at this whole section and see that bread is such an important theme, you know, this can't be accidental. Jesus first feeds the 5,000 in the Jewish territory. In the very next chapter, he will feed the 4,000 in Gentile territory. You have Jesus breaking down the walls between Jews and Gentiles. And here you see it in action. Jesus' mercy, Jesus' grace, the gift of Jesus, the bread that he has, you might say, there's enough for everyone, for the whole world, right? And it overflows. There is enough for everyone. even for those who might have seemed initially unworthy. Well, let's skip into chapter 8, and we come then first, as I mentioned, the story of Jesus' feeding of the 4,000, again, probably to be understood as in Gentile territory. But what I want to come now is 8:14 and following. We have another very striking passage here. And I think I'll just read this one again, starting at 8:14. So they're going to go in the boat again across the lake. Now they had forgotten to bring bread, and they had only one loaf with them in the boat. And he, that is Jesus, cautioned them, saying, "Take heed, beware of the leaven," or you could say the yeast, "of the Pharisees and the yeast of Herod." And they discussed it with one another, saying, "We have no bread." And being aware of it, Jesus said to them, "Why do you discuss the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up?" And they said to him, 12. "And the 7 for the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up?" And they said to him, 7. And he said to them, "Do you not yet understand?" So we have another episode here of Jesus sort of rebuking his disciples for not understanding. If you go back to the beginning of this passage, he warns them to beware of the yeast, or the leaven, of the Pharisees and Herodians. Now, what does that mean, do you think? This image of yeast, what is that an image for? We have here another tiny, almost little parable. It's not quite a parable, but it's a figurative saying, right? Probably their unbelief, yes. Yeast is, you know, if you think of what yeast is used as an image in different places in the Bible, most prominently, of course, in the Exodus story, the Passover, right? In Judaism, at the time of Passover, the Jewish people are to remove all the yeast from their homes. This is given in the book of Exodus, chapter 12. Not eat bread with yeast in it, right? And in Exodus, the reason given for this is it's to be a memorial to them, right? That they didn't have time for the bread to ferment, or, you know, the yeast to act and create the bread. But then yeast becomes an image for the little bit of something that can affect the whole, right? Just like yeast does. You put a little bit of yeast in and it, you know, makes the bread, the loaf expand and so forth. And it can be good or bad in the Bible. So the yeast is often, probably because of the Passover tradition, is often used in a more negative meaning. So it's a sense of a little bit that can perhaps corrupt or influence the whole. Perhaps the image that comes closest for us to this would be maybe the bad apple that spoils the bunch, that kind of a thing, right? It's the little bit that affects the whole. So, but if you look at this in context, you just go back a few verses, the very previous story, look what happens. The Pharisees come and argue with Jesus, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. But Jesus refuses. He doesn't give them a sign. And again, if you look at this in context, look what he's just done. He's just fed 4,000 people. What greater sign do you need? Right? And the Pharisees are yet asking, "Give us a sign. Validate yourself. Prove to us that you are someone we should listen to, a prophet," or whatever. And you see, therefore, that the Pharisees have unbelief, right? They refuse to believe despite what's happening. So perhaps that's really what the yeast is here. If you look at the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew has this passage also. He actually says that the yeast of the Pharisees is their teaching. Okay? But Mark doesn't say that. Mark just leaves the figurative figure there for us to ponder and think about what it might mean. And with, at least within Mark's context, it would seem that it has maybe more to do with unbelief than teaching per se. Because then what happens? Well, the disciples start discussing Jesus' little parable. And they don't get it. Right? Reminds us of chapter 4. Remember what Jesus said back in chapter 4? He gives them a parable. And they ask him, why do you speak in parables? And Jesus says, well, to you has been given the secret, the mystery of the kingdom. So they should understand, right? To those outside, things come in parables so that they won't understand. And yet then the disciples don't understand. They have to ask Jesus. So even here, they still don't get it. They don't understand Jesus' words. They don't understand his little parable. He has to explain it to them. They've seen Jesus feed 5,000 people with a few loaves and fish. They've seen him feed 4,000 people with a few loaves and fish. They don't understand. So, a very strong rebuke here to the disciples. They are, figuratively at least, blind. They see what's going on, but they don't really see. They don't really perceive. And isn't this really what's going on throughout the whole Gospel of Mark? People are seeing what Jesus is doing. He's healing. He is casting out demons. He is teaching. And yet people don't understand. They don't get it. They resist it. Okay? Well, and then the very next passage here then, Jesus will heal a blind man. 8:22-26. They bring a blind man to him and beg him to heal him. And he does. Jesus does heal the man, but it takes him two attempts, which is kind of interesting. The first time he heals this man, his vision is restored, but it still seems things are blurry. He says, I see people walking around, but they look like trees. Okay. And then Jesus heals him a second time, and then he can see clearly. And given the fact that Jesus has just rebuked the disciples for their blindness, again, we are probably intended here to see a very interesting connection here that the disciples also need to be healed in a certain sense, don't they? And it's going to maybe take a little bit of time, though. Jesus is working on them, and it'll maybe take a few attempts. Okay, so let's move into the next section.